Okay, I want to thank the organizers for inviting me. It's nice to be an expert in the Milky Way, and I guess I've decided that I am. After all, I can see the Milky Way from my house. My apologies to those who have not been following the U.S. presidential election. Okay, what am I going to talk about today? Today I'm going to talk about the Sagittarius stream does not go through the solar neighborhood. If anybody is still out there and is unclear on this, I'm going to show you some slides and hopefully we're going to clear that part up. Next, I want to talk about photometrically selecting Sagittarius M giants from SDSS Segway data, which I didn't know I could do before, and now I'm going to show you I can do it. Then I want to do a short presentation of photometric separation of Sagittarius dwarf tidal debris. This is a work of my thesis student, Nate Cole. And then I want to hopefully spend the last, hopefully we have a good amount of time, I can talk about the Chinese LMOS project, because that's what I've actually been spending most of my time recently doing, is trying to set up a collaboration with LMOS. This is a slide from Scott's talk earlier, where he showed the M giants from the Sagittarius dwarf galaxy over here that are going up over the sun and coming down, looking like it's coming almost on the position of where the sun is. And so this paper and a following paper, which showed a theory fit to that data, showing that the leading tidal tail of Sagittarius comes down near the sun, led to a bunch of things. In fact, I wrote papers with particle physicists trying to figure out how this would affect direct detection of dark matter. However, I don't think that this, I now don't believe this is correct, and I'm going to show you this way. Here's the Milky Way galaxy. Here is us. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at the whole sky, but I'm going to cut it in magnitude. I'm going to look at F turnoff stars, and I'm going to make magnitude cuts so that I'm looking at the sky sort of 10 kiloparsecs away, sort of 20 kiloparsecs away, and sort of 30 kiloparsecs away. And these are polar plots. You may have seen in Eric Bell's paper similar kinds of plots. But here you go. Here are F turnoff stars selected to be on average about 11 kiloparsecs away. Here's the North Galactic Pole. Here's the Monoceros stream towards the anticenter, and the galactic center is over there. If you go out to an average of 18 kiloparsecs, you see the Virgo overdensity over here, and you see the Sagittarius stream over here at L equals 200, which means if you're here in the sun, and that's directly overhead, you're seeing the Sagittarius stream towards the galactic anticenter. Okay? 18 kiloparsecs away, not 10 kiloparsecs away from us. 18 kiloparsecs away, and then if you go out 30 kiloparsecs, then you can see it directly overhead in the galaxy. All right? So it goes past us. And in fact, if you go through the SDSS data and you try to say, where does the Sagittarius stream go? And you lay this on top of the two mass observations, you see that, for one thing, we have a slight distance offset, systematic distance offset from the distances for the M giants. That's part of what's going on. But at any rate, even if the distance is wrong, it still is, even if you scale it back to theirs. I think ours is right, but I don't know. You see that this is coming, you know, maybe 25 kiloparsecs from the galactic center is where I would guess it's going through the plane. Okay. So here's the model from Law, Johnson, and Majeski. Here's, you know, this is where we're seeing this stuff going. It's not going where the model goes at all. And in fact, Amina Helmy sent me this in email, and she said, "Hey, look at it fits the prolate model better." But of course, there are other problems with the models and the velocities. So that's just kind of an idea. There are different models that would take it out there. Now, one of the things in that paper, which was Newberg et al., 2007, that I wondered about was, if you look at this, this is where the Virgo overdensity is, you know, sort of 15 kiloparsecs up above our heads, a little bit towards quadrant four. And one of the things I worried about is in the Law, Johnson, and Majeski paper is that a lot of the M giants that were used in the velocities, this is velocities along the Sagittarius stream, a lot of them were, you know, kind of 15 kiloparsecs up over our head, and those M giants, those are the velocities that didn't match any of the models here. Those are the ones that were hard to fit. And so I was actually worried that that because the model had expected the stars to come down right down on our heads, that they were taking stars from this area of the sky, and those stars weren't maybe even Sagittarius stars. And this is a paper by Monaco et al., where you know they found actually some stars that would fit on one of these models here, and then there's some other stars over here which kind of spread all over the place, which you know maybe could have been part of something. So one of the things that we've been doing recently, I've been doing this with Brian Yenny. Maybe other people knew this. I did not know until recently that we could select. I knew we could select VHBs, K giants spectroscopically, F turnoff stars if they're blue. But I didn't know that we could photometrically select M giants, and we can do that. Here's a color in U minus G and G minus R. Here's a stellar locus at the red end, and if you select stars that are particularly red in U minus G at the red end of the locus in G minus R, these are all M giant stars in Sagittarius. And to prove that to you, here's the color magnitude diagram from a 2002 paper, looking at the leading. The leading tidal tail of Sagittarius, and you see the turn off, the giant branch, the horizontal branch, and the blue stragglers. And what we did is we took the exact same part of the sky this diagram was made from, and we selected the M giants in U minus G, G minus R color space. And of course, you can only do that on the red end. And you see, you can find now the M giant branch in the Sagittarius stream. With SDSS stars, okay, and we actually checked this using SDSS spectra, and you'll find the SDSS spectra of things that are M giants in that region of the sky fall right along this line. So we can select M giants in Sagittarius. So one of the things we've tried to do recently is to take the blue horizontal branch stars that are right on what you know where I believe the leading tidal tail of Sagittarius go. And the M giants that are right along where I think the leading tidal tail of Sagittarius is, and you know this way we kind of avoid that Virgo region, and plot what the velocities we find are, and it actually turns out we get this: we have Sagittarius M giants in red, we have Sagittarius blue horizontal branch stars in black, and then we had to separate out, because you'll see in a moment why, we separate out of the ones that had low metallicity from the SDSS spectra from the ones that had metallicity closer, very low metallicity from the ones that had metallicity closer to the Sagittarius ones. And just to guide your eye, if you looked at the Law, Johnson, and Majeski paper, their data in there, the data, not the model, the data kind of follows these lines here, just copied it out of their paper. And so you see that even though we're selecting stuff right where I think that leading tidal tail of Sagittarius goes, we get the same velocities they got. So I don't know. I don't know what's going on there. The other thing you see, the reason that we selected out the low metallicity blue horizontal branch stars as being separate is because there was this lump here, and that so that so this part of the stream didn't fit. And it turns out, I think, that that's just another piece of tidal debris. And this is, you know, every time I try to look at something in the SDSS and Segler data, there's another lump, or there's another stream, or there's another something that I don't know what it is. And this is no exception, I mean, every time. So that's the result from that. Okay, so the third thing that I wanted to tell you. I have a graduate student who's been working on a maximum likelihood fit to the Sagittarius dwarf. How does this work? Well, this is the celestial equator, the first part of the sky that Sloan ever took. And this is towards the galactic center, and this is the Sagittarius stream. And what we would like to be able to do is to, you know, what we've been doing now in the Sagittarius streams, you know, we've been plotting velocity as a function of distance around the stream. We've been plotting distance as a function of, you know, distance around the stream. And there's just a whole lot more information in the Sagittarius stream than that. You know, there's really many dimensions here. And so what we wanted to be able to do was to separate out, and another motivation for this was that there are so many enormous lumps like the Sagittarius stream in the spheroid that I've never really been able to fit the smooth spheroid has been a really big problem. And so one of the things I'd like to be able to do is say, okay, let's separate the density of the Sagittarius stream out into that set of stars and the density of the smooth part that's not the Sagittarius stream out into that part of the star so that we can look at them separately. So we can compare the Sagittarius stream with models and cut it in different directions and compare it with models, and we can take the smooth part and we can try to fit that to a separate set of models. One way to do that is maximum likelihood. Now, you can probably easily think of something you might want to fit to a smooth component of the background. Probably wrong, but you can think of something you might want to try to fit. But trying to think of a model, a formula for a model for a Sagittarius stream is not easy. And so what we're fitting for the Sagittarius stream is 2.5 degrees wide right elliptical cross-section cylinders. So it's just a piecewise fit to the Sagittarius stream and then some smooth component to the other part of it. And we're doing this for historical reasons, one stripe at a time. There's really no reason that we have to do it that way, but we're fitting it one stripe, one SDSS stripe at a time. And we now have a procedure. This is from Cole et al., I think 2008, if it's that recent, where we can fit, we can find the best fit Gaussian cross-section stream piece to this, and the best fit, you know, power law spheroid, or actually we're using a Hernquist profile, to the background. And then we can't tell you in this part of the diagram that this is a Sagittarius star and this is a smooth spheroid star. That's not possible. But what we can do is we can pick up each star in that area of the sky and say, what's the probability that I'm from the Sagittarius stream and what's the probability I'm from the smooth background? And then I can put it in one of these categories with those probabilities. So, you know, if you wanted to spectroscopically pick which stars you're going to try to follow up to get the velocities, you don't do this. You just pick everything that's in this area of the sky. But if you want to study the density of the Sagittarius stream and the density of the spheroid, you would do this. So this would be a density thing. And so you find when we do this maximum likelihood fit, you can pick out things that have the density of Sagittarius and things that have what looks like a fairly smooth density of the background. Now, this has taken us many years to do, and one of the reasons was it took more computing time than we had. And so the success that we've had recently has been because we have a collaboration now with a bunch of computer scientists who know how to turn our code into parallelized code and run it on a multiprocessor at the same time. One of the interesting parts of this project is that we now have a Milky Way at home application, which you may recognize from SETI at home. And you know, even though we're in still an alpha stage, we probably should go to beta. We have 6,300 users. We have 22,000 CPUs available to us in any given time. There are 600 teams from 99 countries, and we've distributed 400 million Boink credits. Now, I had never heard of a Boink credit before, but Boink credits are kind of like when you play the pinball machines when you were a kid, you know, and you get to if your points get up really high, then your name gets to the top of a list on the pinball machine. And Boink credits work a lot like that. If you volunteer your CPU time to the cause, then you get credits, and then your name goes up on a website in order of how many credits you've got per project for the whole thing. And this is such a big carrot for so many people that there's a guy in D.C. whose screen name is Cruncher who spent 2 months and took all of our code and wrote it in assembly language to run on his multi-threaded whatever the heck machine he has so that it runs like 4 times faster on his machine than our code would run on his machine. It's caused an international scramble. We got phone calls and email and flame wars on its website and stuff, because this guy was trying to claim too much credit. He was getting credit too fast. So, you know, this is something that, you know, is that we're now having to deal with in getting our computing time, is to understand where the fairness is in how to distribute credits among people who want to write the code in assembly language and those who don't. This unbelievable stuff happens when you get involved with Boink. But at any rate, we have a lot of compute power available and only growing as long as they don't get mad at us for the credits that we give out. I actually think that if we just gave out 10 times as much credit as any other project, we'd get them all. All the Boink people. All right. But at any rate, we're now up to three of the three southern stripes have been done because they're the easiest. The northern ones, we have to worry about multiple streams in each thing, so we have to worry about that. But we've done the three in the south. So here's a Sagittarius dwarf. Here's the leading tidal tail. Here's the trailing tidal tail. And we get the direction of the stream at each point, which is not velocity. That's a 15. That's 50. That's a 15. Okay. What is that? 6? No, 15. Okay. thank you. So we get a direction, but it's a direction of the density. It has nothing to do with the velocity, right? This is only photometric data. And these two are actually exactly what we expected. This one is not, and we're still struggling with that one stripe as to whether whether there's a problem. I mean, the statistical errors in fitting this are really quite small, and the question is how big are the systematic errors? I mean, because if your model, if the stream isn't a Gaussian cross-section cylindrically shaped thing, then you're not going to match, right? So you'll get some bigger errors than there really are. But at any rate, so we're finding a full width half max of the stream for all these. It's somewhere in the 6.5 kiloparsecs. There are about 10,000 or 17,000 stars per stripe. And given that of this type of turnoff star is like 1.8 million in the Sagittarius dwarf, it's still less than 1% for each of these 2.5-degree stripes in the south. So we're going to be able to trace this stream around in density and in cross-sectional density and everything. So that's what we're working on now. And we're also working on getting pretty pictures. You can see why we're a little concerned about this stripe over here, because we expect it to be pointing this way along the stream. So when you have a stripe, a 2.5-degree wide stripe on the sky, and I'm going to fit a Gaussian cross section and Gaussian density cross section cylinder to that. So if the stream comes through perpendicular to your stripe, then the arrow would point perpendicular to your data, right? And if the stream comes in like this, I mean, it's going to move it around. It's actually the biggest error is in fitting that direction, not in fitting the width or anything else. So there's a lot of details to maximum likelihood fitting. I'm sorry. The white dots are simulation, which is actually a copy of the Law-Johnson-Majeski simulation. It was actually done by one of my graduate students, but it was done by exactly copying what they did. And then this is this data here is the data we've extracted from each of these three stripes in this area. And then the arrows tell you where the stripe goes through where the stream goes through each of the stripes at this end, and then the direction is the direction of the center of the cylindrical axis. That's right. This is data. This is a model. So over here, it's not fitting the model. But I don't know if that's real or not. Okay? All right. So now I want to switch topics again, and I want to talk about LAMOST. LAMOST is, what does it stand for even? Large area... That's something spectral. Multi-object spectral telescope. And it's a project where they're building basically a 4-meter telescope with 4,000 fibers. It's at Shenlong Observing Station, which when I went a year ago last summer, took me 3 hours to get there. Now it only takes 2 hours. The first time, you know, it was terrible traffic in Beijing, and then there was a dirt road going out to the observatory, and the road went back and forth and back and forth, and we had to stop every once in a while so the graduate students could puke out the window. And, you know, it was quite a crazy trip to get up there. It's now 2 hours, you know, that you can take in an Audi. You know, and in Beijing with the Olympics, they closed it down so there's no traffic in Beijing, and they paved the road, and there's flowers all the way down the side, so you have this beautiful drive up to the observatory. You can now make it in 2 hours. And I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, because it's a little less remote from Beijing now than it was then. But that's where it is. It's a Schmidt-type telescope. It's a little more complicated because I'll show you in a minute. It's an Altaz. The focal length is 20 meters. All right, so 20 meters would be a very long telescope tube, and keep that in mind because that's going to be the answer to your question: why did they do it this way? It has a 5-degree diameter field of view, which gives you a 1.75 meters in the focal plane. It's a meridian telescope. You can only move it within about an hour and a half in right ascension, and you can move it from 90 degrees to minus 10 degrees in declination, but the closer you get to 90 degrees, the less you can move it in right ascension without losing quality of your focus. There are 16 spectrographs in there, each with 250 fibers, and you can get actually well more than 10,000 spectra a night. It's about 2 million spectra a year at that site. And I started getting involved with this because I'm looking at all the stuff you've seen in this meeting. There's all this structure in velocity space, and I don't think I really need to talk about what the science case would be for doing a galactic structure survey on a telescope that has 4,000 fibers to this group. But one key point about this that I wanted to talk about was this: there's a satellite called Gaia, which is supposed to be launched in 2011. This satellite is only going to get it's going to get proper motions for a billion galactic stars, but it's only going to get radio velocities for the stars that are brighter than 17th magnitude. So LMOS is actually in a really good position to get an interesting number of radio velocities for stars between 17th and 20th magnitude that can be matched eventually with Gaia to get what we all want, which is the angular momentum of all of the stars, to try to in velocity space, deconstruct how the halo formed. It's also apparently good for getting these low metallicity stars. So you look through a lot of stars, you can find some that are low metallicity. And it's complementary to things like Rave, which is brighter, and Segway 2, which has many fewer stars, and WIFMOS, which is only in the planning stages. Another reason that I really think that this is important, I mean, I've now, this Monoceros stream was discovered in 2002. So for 6 years now, people have been fighting about what it is, what its progenitor is, whether it's a tidal debris, whether it's a disk galaxy, whether it puffed up the thick disk or became the thick disk, and what this has really taught me is how little we know about the disk. I mean, if it's taken 6 years of fighting on both sides of this, and we still don't know if this is a disk component that was dredged up or a satellite that was dragged in, tells us we really don't understand the disk. So there's actually, I think, a big need to have more data in the spheroid and the disk and the thin disk to understand, how these components are related to each other. The LMOS telescope system works like this. This is the primary mirror up here of the Schmidt telescope. So this is the one that is a curved surface, okay? And this telescope here, or this mirror, has 37 hexagonal submirrors. They're each a little over a meter. They have a radius of curvature of 40 meters, and this is actually not 4 meters across. It's 6 meters this way and 6.7 meters that way. So it's a much bigger mirror up there. So it's a primary up there, and then the instrument, the focal plane is here. This part here is the Schmidt corrector. And usually we don't refer to this as the primary. We call this mirror A and that mirror B, because then it's a less confusing. Okay? So this Schmidt corrector, all of these mirrors are flat mirrors, except that each of these flat mirrors has 34 force actuators plus 3 mount points on each of the submirrors. And so this can be used to correct the focus of LaMost, so that, you know, without doing this correction to the folk, having a corrector in there, the seeing is, I don't know, 10 arc seconds, something really enormous. So this mirror has to be carefully controlled in order to get the light to go down each of the little fibers that are in this focal plane over here. Okay? Now, this distance here is very long. And it's long enough that one cannot imagine building a telescope with a tube that long that you can point over here and point over there. Okay? So the reason this telescope looks like this is that this mirror is fixed at that point in the ground and moves around like the primary of a regular Altaz telescope would. That mirror is fixed. Okay, so the light is going to come from somewhere in the sky. It's going to hit here, and it's going to bounce over here. And the reason this mirror has to be so much bigger than that mirror is that you're going to hit different parts of this mirror depending on where you go in the sky. That's why we don't call it the primary mirror. This is mirror A, and this is mirror B. But if you're used to a Schmidt telescope, this mirror is like the primary of a Schmidt telescope. I don't know what the definition is. Okay. So this was a year ago last summer when I went, and you see that, you know, things are, it's a wild west in China. It was a crazy trip up there. People just standing up there on the top of the telescope. They had to pull me out of the way when I walked past someone welding with sparks going all over the place. So it was quite crazy. And, you know, I think some people would have run screaming. There's, I don't know, something about my personality that I saw all of this. And because I think it has the best potential for unraveling formation history, dark matter potential, so I'm going to be traveling 12 time zones, which is how far it is for me to get there, at least 8 times in 2 years. I committed my sabbatical year to get to survey planning and started learning Chinese. I also put together something called Participants in LaMost U.S., which has, you know, about 15 people in the U.S. and a similar number in China, and we even have another logo, which matches the LaMost logo. And we're looking at designing a survey that can be done on galactic structure with LaMost and buying in some way. This is mostly, not this one, but most of these pictures are from my trip there the week before last. This is the primary mirror. You'll notice that all of the mirror segments are there. This is, or not the primary, it's the mirror A. This is mirror B, and this is me taking a picture of mirror B. So this is the mirror on that back part of that wall. So if this is the one where if you look up at this part of it here, that's that mirror there. And all of the mirror segments are in that one as well. These are the actuators on the back. They wouldn't let me take pictures of the actuators on that back of mirror A because that you can't see. There's a whole air conditioning system. Inside the tube of the telescope is this black aluminum, and then there's a gap, and then on the outside is this concrete that you see from the outside of the LaMost telescope, and in between that is all temperature controlled because they're concerned no one's ever done this before. The telescope, they don't know what kind of dome seeing you're going to get from having a tube like this that all that light has to go down. So that's something that is a big unknown about this telescope. This is the focal plane. This is the backside of the focal plane, so the light from mirror B would come down this way and hit these fibers here, and you can see the fibers coming out the back of this focal plane instrument. This is the front of the focal plane instrument, and this is 4,000 little fibers in here. This is a focus CCD for the active optics. These are guide CCDs here. If you come in closer to those, you can see the little things that move. And now these things here only move the fibers about 2 arc minutes, or 2.8 arc minutes, almost 3 arc minutes. They can only move at about 3 arc minutes from the nominal position, okay, each of those things. So there are very strong constraints on what this can see. It's a meridian telescope. You can only look at the RA you're at. You can only move the fibers 2.8 arc minutes from the position that it's at. Here are the fibers going down from the instrument down to the spectrographs. There are 2 floors of spectrograph rooms, 8 spectrographs on each floor. All those spectrographs are there. All the fibers are there. These are the mirrors that are covered by the these drapes, and one of the reasons is there's a lot of stuff in the air in China, and they always have everything covered if it's not in use, and so there actually are issues. The mirror A of the telescope is going to have to be cleaned every day. This is components of the spectrograph. One of the people asked me about the gratings. The gratings are very big. That's my hand. That's a grating. The gratings for these telescopes are very big, and there are 32 of them, right? And you keep in mind. This is a spectrum of, I think, a calibration lamp that they've just started to take with these things. And when I came away from this site, I was told that commissioning was supposed to start in December. But when I was there, the big problem was that the CCDs for the guiding could not be read out, and they couldn't find anyone in Italy where they'd gotten them. Turns out the problem was they were using USB 1 and they needed USB 2. I mean, this is the level of problems that we have right now with the instruments there. I mean, and I asked the guy when I was there, I said, when are you ready for me to send you targets? And he said, well, now, you know, might as well test with real ones. So, you know, this telescope, as far as I'm concerned, is in commissioning. It is all there. Every scrap of instrumentation is there. Okay, and these are the fireworks over the Paralympics in Beijing. All right, I want to show this slide because this is another really important thing to know about. I know I'm going over a little bit. It's a really important thing to know about LAMOST. This shows you the sky above, you know, minus 10 degrees declination. This is the Sloan area here, the North Galactic Cap. This is the galactic plane right there, okay? This shows you, as a function of right ascension going from 0 to 24, in gray, it shows you where the right ascensions are of the Sloan area, okay? The bottom plot shows you, as a function of month, how many hours of good weather they've had in the last 4 years at this site, all right? So keep in mind, this is a meridian telescope. You can only look at the RA that you're at, all right? So that means that if you want to look at an RA that's near the galactic center, you can't with this telescope because you will never get any good weather when that part of the sky is up. All of the good weather is where the galactic anti-center is up. And so this telescope has to be run as a survey. And it has to be run as a survey that likes to look at that part of the sky. Okay, it will get some of the North Galactic Cap and some of the South Galactic Cap, but it can't spend most of its time there, which is actually a good thing for the Galactic Structure Survey. So we're looking at targeting with supercosmos because that's the only thing that we have in that area. That's the brightness at the site as a function of year, which is an issue. These are the plates we're currently designing. I expect it to go into survey operations at the beginning of 2010, and the prospects for a galactic structure survey are very good. We're looking at millions of spectra over a five-year period. We have a website. We're planning proposals, including a Center for Galactic E-Science is the one I'm currently working on, but if that doesn't work, it's going to be broken up into many, many different proposals. And so, you know, that's kind of the stage that we're at. Let's stop there.
So I had this horrible feeling that I was looking at the McMath Solar Telescope when you started talking about the running coolant through the walls, because they've tried to do that for years, not very successfully. So what is the delivered seeing?
We don't know yet. I mean, the delivered seeing is currently based on simulations. I expect within the next weeks that we will know something about it. However, what they're most worried about right now is the actuators, the 37 actuators per mirror segment on each of 24 different mirrors and getting, because those are the bigger problem at the moment.
I'm going to ask you the same question that you asked me.
Oh, no, what was that?
I've been listening to this talk, and I've been thinking about Segway, and I've been trying to understand what has come out of Segway that could not have been anticipated. So could you please tell me the great highlights of Segway?
For me, the what I've been able to get out of Segway is a lot of... So I actually designed Segway in the beginning. And the reason that Segway is the way it is because in SDSS 1, we found all of these lumpy structures in the spheroid, okay? And clearly, all of these lumps needed to be followed up spectroscopically, and these were big. I mean, these are things that are 10 kiloparsecs across. So it was impossible to understand the details of what the galaxy looks like because there are these enormous big things out there that that we didn't have traced at all. And so a lot of the tracing that's been done now has been in density space. Clearly, that has to change. I mean, as we start to understand the big picture of what the galaxy looks like, I think we're sort of at now. We know where the really biggest lumps are. You need to start, one, getting spectral of all those big lumps so you can kind of trace them around and understand how they work. And two, you want to go down to lower lower brightness contrast of each structure, and you have to do that doing spectra. Segway just finished getting 250,000 spectra 2 months ago. So there's an enormous amount of data that's in there that hasn't been analyzed. But we have been able to do things like trace streams, find multiple streams in the Virgo area, only scratching the surface actually with SDSS 1 data. We're looking at multiple populations in the spheroid. I mean, the kinematics of how the galaxy and the Segway basically looks at the spheroid are really just beginning to be unraveled. And the reason Segway looks like it does is because I was trying to find the biggest structures. So I wanted to sample every 15 degrees because these structures were, 15, 20 degrees across. I wanted to find all the big ones because without finding the big ones, I used to go to AAS conferences and people would bring me plots. And the plots would be color magnitude diagrams of some region of the sky they were looking at and would have something that looks like it might be a turnoff. And they'd show it to me and say, is this a turnoff? And I would say, I don't know. I don't know what it's supposed to look like. You know, there wasn't any, there's not a supposed to look like you can compare it to that ever looks like it. You know, so you have to understand the big, large scale of what's going on. And Segway was designed to do that. Clearly, we need to move beyond that. And so having a bigger survey where you can fill in the gaps between it, I mean, we found that with the photometric survey, very little large-scale structure of the galaxy, the way I would put it, very little substructure in the galaxy has come from the southern stripes because there's not enough contiguous data to see something that's really big across. And the same thing has happened with Segway. What's happened is that when I look at the data, I see substructure in every little piece. If I locate any piece of the sky in position space and look at the velocities, the structure to me does not look like it's drawn from a Gaussian. And so what's happened with Segway is we're finding that you see structure on every scale you look at, which is very similar to what happened when SDSS began, when we were looking at large-scale structures of galaxies and seeing structure on every scale that had been looked at before. You know that if you went to a very much bigger survey, you would find many more structures. You know, so it's kind of analogous to that. You know, that we know if we had a bigger survey, if we knew if it were contiguous, we knew if we could understand the statistics of it better, that we could start to answer more fundamental questions about what the galaxy looks like. With Segway, really all that we can do is trace around structures that we see in density space because there's not the statistical power to pull things out that are correlated in density and velocity.
More questions?
I was going to say, right.
I was having trouble following what went wrong in the previous solar system, dark matter stream hitting us. What was the essential thing that was a mistake previously that was corrected?
I don't know that I would call it a mistake.
Well, anyway, let me
show you.
Before and now is correct.
That before was with two mass data following M giant stars. Okay? Let me do this. And the strength of having it go through the solar neighborhood rests on this piece over here of the stream. Now you watch, here it goes up. You can see that there's a stream here. And here it comes around, and the density falls off. Now I got to ask you, does it go over here? Or does it go over here? Or is this a big fat thing like this that's coming down as a big fat thing straight down
on
the sun?
Do people really make models like that, or do they try to make self-consistent models based on the available kinematic data and so forth?
People make self-consistent models based on the kinematic data, but I got to tell you, the models don't fit all the data, right? Here's the model, and there's their data. Right? Uh-huh. It doesn't fit over here.
So why are you saying definitively now that it doesn't come through?
Because you can see it. Here's the Sagittarius stream leading tidal tail. Here it is going past us and down over the galactic anticenter.
Okay, but these diagrams were available a few years ago, weren't they?
Yes, and a few years ago.
Can I jump?
This is from last year.
Okay. We weren't trying to make the Sagittarius, Andy, I just answer you, because I don't think Heidi's got it wrong as such. I mean, we weren't trying to make our streams go through the solar neighborhood. We were just trying to fit the velocities, and we didn't have very accurate distances. And we were unable to fit the velocities. Amina pointed out that you can fit the velocities in a prolate halo. But there is this remaining difficulty that Heidi is helping to try and sort out, that the precession of the streams fit in an oblate halo and the velocities fit in a prolate halo. There is no stream model that fits all the data. So if Heidi's helped sort out that we should believe that velocity data, so actually the controversy remains. So she's just clearing up. She's just checking that it couldn't. It's not that the velocities are wrong.
No,
and we're,
doesn't
we were
appear to be
wrong
that the velocities are wrong.
So we're still stuck, in other words, or it's a nice project.
Yeah, the models don't fit the data, but the data doesn't go through the solar neighborhood.
Amina, did you want to comment?
That also, if you look at the distance distribution of the predicted distance distribution for the extension of the leading stream, then the prolate models also give you the right distances, I think. I still can't get the precision right.
Any other questions? Comments? All right, Mario, why don't you come on up? We'll take our seat again.